Okay, let's say we didn't manage to stop acting out our mental afflictions. So now we're at step five, and we have engaged in some verbal or physical behaviour. And what I want to do here is focus on harmful, negative behaviour. Because what we said yesterday was that if we do some harmful, negative behaviour, that leaves an imprint in our mind, and that will later ripen as some sort of suffering experience for us. So what can we do to avoid experiencing the result? And we briefly talked yesterday about this idea of purification, that we can purify our mind of these negative habits and negative imprints. So let's now have a look at an effective strategy of how to purify our mind of these negative imprints and negative habits. And here, in our purification practice, we can talk about four things we can do. And these are called the four opponent powers. And each one of these can help to reduce and eliminate the imprint and reduce and eliminate negative habits. The first of those is regret. Meaning, if we've done some harmful negative behaviour, to develop some sincere regret for having done that action. So that's already going to weaken the imprint, weaken the habit. Now here, of course, we need to distinguish between regret and guilt. So remember, we saw yesterday that if we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Bad me. So guilt comes from cognitive fusion, and guilt is completely useless because all it does is it paralyzes us and makes us feel bad. It doesn't even address the negative behavior. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything, and guilt comes from cognitive fusion by identifying ourselves with our negative behavior, which is what unfortunately we often do in our modern society. And that leads not only to guilt, but of course low self-esteem and even self-hatred, because I'm just a bad person. So avoid cognitive fusion, because it's a false perspective. We are not our behavior. We have done that action. So if we avoid cognitive fusion, we can develop regret. Because if we regret, we're regretting the behavior. So regret comes from a correct perspective, acknowledging I have done this harmful behaviour. Then we can have compassion for ourselves, forgiveness for ourselves. We can have sincere regret for having done that negative behaviour. And then on top of that regret, we can do three more things. The second is called reliance, or sometimes translated as foundation. Now, we're all trying to sort of follow a particular good direction in our life. So we all have some sort of foundation for the direction of our life. If we've done something harmful or negative, we've sort of fallen down from our foundation, our direction, positive direction in life. So this second power is about picking ourselves back up and reaffirming the positive direction in our life. And in Buddhism, that takes on a very specific form, which we haven't talked about yet, but we will talk about it. But if we want to keep it simple, then all that this is having done a negative behavior on top of regretting it, to reaffirm the positive direction that we want to follow our life. So that also will have a purifying effect on our negative imprint, negative tendencies, because it's opposite.
Is that like a vow?
not so much a vow, it's just reaffirming our positive direction. Like here we could say, I want to benefit others as much as I can in my life, as an example. Reliance, to rely on something. We're relying on something in our life, and we're relying on, you know, helping others, or we're relying on being a good person, or we're relying on being ethical, for example. Yes. In Buddhism, at the highest level, this would be what's called bodhicitta, which is an aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help to liberate others from suffering. So that's sort of the highest level. Is that we say, what I want to do in my life is I want to aspire to become fully enlightened so I can help to liberate everyone else from suffering. That would be a Buddhist, one Buddhist thing to do here. The third opponent power is remedy. So remedy means to think of some sort of practical remedy for what we did. For example, let's say we verbally abused someone at work. So a practical remedy, just simply apologize. So if we can think of some direct positive opposite action, best. But sometimes it's not possible to do something directly positive opposite to the harmful thing we did. Then if we do any positive action with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative habit, that's also very effective. Of course, the long-term remedy for all negative behaviour is that all negative behaviour, of course, is based on ignorance. So the long-term remedy here is to come to realise the nature of reality. Because if we can directly realise the nature of reality, we will wipe out all negative imprints, negative tendencies in our mind. That's the long-term strategy. Short-term, practical remedy.
Can you repeat and run? Can you please repeat for the short-term remedy?
Short-term remedy. Again, if you verbally abuse someone, apologise. If you took someone from something from someone, give it back.
If it's not possible,
then do any good thing with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative habit. You know, if we have a habit of lying that we really want to overcome, then do any good thing with a motivation. By doing this, I'm doing this so that I can overcome that negative habit. That's also effective. And the fourth thing we can do is what's called resolve, which is a strong determination not to do that negative thing again. And here we need to be very practical. Because if the negative thing we did is a very strong habit, there's no point in saying, I'm never going to do that again. It's not going to happen. For example, if we have a strong habit of lying, there's no point here saying, I'm never going to lie again, because we've just told another lie. So here, if it's a very strong habit, set a time limit. Say, for the next day, I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next hour, I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next 5 minutes, I'm not going to do that thing. So pick an amount of time that with some effort, normally you can manage. And then, over time, you can extend that 5 to 10 minutes to an hour, to a day, a week, a month, the rest of your life. So in that way, we can even start to break strong habits if we have that time limit.
The psychology of that, not so much in actions, but in thinking. If we, experiments being done, if we say to someone, okay, I don't want you to think about a polar bear for the next 2 minutes, it's almost impossible to not think about it because you've literally set the seed.
Right. So what we can do here is frame it in the positive opposite.
Yes.
For lying, for the next 5 minutes, I'm going to tell the truth.
Right.
So this is a good point, and I think this can be very helpful. You know, if, to frame it in the positive opposite, if possible, because then it's really much like you said, otherwise we're still thinking about lying or stealing or whatever. So what we attend to becomes our reality. So like the 10 virtues, to do that resolve, if possible, to do the positive opposite. For the next day, I'm going to, you know, if it's like we're verbally aggressive to people at work, for the next day, I'm going to say kind things to everyone at work. That would be more helpful.
Can you just repeat the definition again?
Of resolve?
Yeah.
It's just a determination not to do it again. So again, I think it can be even more helpful to do to frame it in the positive opposite.
Yeah.
So these are the four potent powers. Of course, ideally, when we've done a particular negative behaviour, immediately we can go through these steps. At least what's very practical and helpful is at the end of the day, before we go to bed, review the day. How did the day go? And if there are any particularly heavy negative actions we did, before we go to bed, we can go through that process. That's also effective. And with Renato, you're going to be doing a purification practice involving these four steps that are packaged in a particular way, and so you're going to do that with Renato's this evening. So there's many ways of packaging this, and one way in Tibetan Buddhism, you're going to have a little bit of a taste of that this evening with Renato. But again, whatever, however you package what you do for purification, if we can have these four elements present, is most effective. So that's what we can do here. Any questions about this before I look at step six?
Just on the word regret.
Right.
Are we using that similar to how we normally use the word? Like, is it regret wishing that that did not happen or wishing that I didn't do that?
Regret, sincere regret, involves understanding that that was a harmful behaviour. You know, of course we can just sort of mouth the words, you know, oh, I'm sorry for doing that, without really meaning it. So then it's not regret. So regret only comes from an understanding that it was harmful and a wish to overcome it. Then we can have sincere regret. I mean, of course we can say all sorts of words and pretend that we regret, but we don't really. And we just keep doing it. Then there's no sincere regret.
But it's good that he reminded me that in our culture, a lot of people tend to regret what they did and then they live in the past and they don't...
And that is cognitive fusion.
Okay.
So that's it. And that's what we do. We identify ourselves with our past behaviour.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a disaster.
Exactly.
It's a disaster. That's cognitive fusion. And then usually we're not really regretting, we're just feeling guilty. You know, oh, I'm so guilty. I did all those horrible things when I was younger. Oh, I'm a bad person. I'm a bad person. I'm no hope for me. I don't deserve forgiveness, compassion.
Right.
Then we're stuck. No? And it's completely useless. It's an invalid perspective.
Can you give that practical example for life?
Yeah. Well, as a Buddhist, at the highest level, as I mentioned, it would involve reaffirming our aspiration to achieve enlightenment so that we can liberate everyone from suffering. I mean, that's like the sort of the highest level. But, you know, at our level, we could maybe have simply my goal in life is to benefit others as much as I can. Or my goal in life is to always speak in a kind way to others. Or my goal in life is to use my talents to benefit society as much as I can. We can make it as we want.
That's purifying a bad action that we did?
Yes, because that is an intention. Yeah, we have an intention to do this, and that is working against the imprint in our mind.
Right. It changes and that prevents further karma.
Correct. So this is a preventative measure. This is what we do after the event. So of course, we want this to fix if we've done something, but of course, if that's all we do, we want preventative measures like that so that we stop doing these behaviours to begin with as well. So we need both.
Reliance can be also on small things?
Sure.
Like not say going live, but going for the day?
Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. Because often, sometimes when we have these sort of very general aspirations for life, it's sort of very vague, and then in daily life we don't remember it. But often at the beginning of a day, if we say, today at work I'm going to be kind to everybody, then we sort of remember that. But if we just say, I'm going to be kind to everyone for the rest of my life, probably we're still going to get angry at people at work and not remember that. But yes, that's a very practical thing to do. Say, today at work, for the rest of today, I'm going to be kind to everyone at work. And that's very practical. Right. Let's say we didn't manage to do this and we're now experiencing the result. And again, I want to just focus on when we're experiencing some sort of unpleasant suffering result. So, is there something we can do in the moment with regard to that, to improve the situation? So we're currently experiencing some sort of suffering result. Can we do anything? Or nothing to do?
If it's not permanent, it's not a task.
Yes. So this is one good strategy is, and this is something that I sort of instinctively tended to use many years ago when I had some sort of fairly heavy thing happening and I couldn't find an answer to it. I often just went, this too shall pass. Tomorrow will be different. And that automatically eased my discomfort. So I think this is very helpful. Anything else we can do?
Renouncing.
What do you mean by renouncing? Accept. Yeah. Acceptance is the thing. And that's the key element here, really, is this what's called acceptance. And acceptance doesn't mean resignation. Acceptance simply means, in the present moment, I'm experiencing this suffering experience. I can either accept that fact or I can have aversion to it and try and push it away. And what we understood was, having aversion, all that does is magnifies our suffering. So we can practice acceptance, and one way of practicing acceptance, again using the advice from Shanti Deva in the back corner of the room there, if a situation can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. And if a situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? No point. It too will pass. So if we can practice that simple advice, that is acceptance. I'm experiencing this. Can I do something about it? Yes, I can. Okay, let's fix it. I'm experiencing this. Can I do something about it? Nope. Okay, it'll pass. If we can do that, at least we won't magnify the amount of suffering we experience. So that's something we can do very well. And on top of that, there's one more thing I think we can do, which we're going to look at a little bit tomorrow. And that is that often one of the reasons we develop aversion to unpleasant things is that we are focused on ourselves obsessively. Me, 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 me. And so with that obsessive self-focus, we often go, oh, I don't want to suffer, I don't want to suffer, I don't want to suffer. And then automatically we have aversion to anything unpleasant. So one thing that can be very helpful here is not have this obsessive self-focus, is also focus on others. And then actually we can turn a difficult suffering experience into something that we can use in the spiritual path. For example, let's say we're having a migraine headache. And our experience is even if we take medication, it doesn't really help. We just have to wait it out. Then, of course, if we develop aversion, we go, oh, no, not migraine headache again, go away, go away. All that will happen is we'll magnify many-fold suffering we experience. So first step is, okay, I can't do anything about this, it'll pass. So we don't averge. But on top of that, what we can do is go, okay, I'm not the only person on the planet right now who's got a migraine headache. Probably thousands of other people with migraine headaches and maybe much worse than mine. So then we can say, okay, by me willingly accepting this migraine headache, may all others be free of their migraine headaches. Compassion. And so if we can have that attitude, one is that we're focusing on others, we're not obsessive self-focus, much less chance of aversion. And then on top of that, we're using this opportunity to develop compassion. So it can be a meaningful exercise. And often what you will find is that because you have a strong focus on others with compassion, often that compassion will even overwhelm the discomfort you are experiencing. You know, we see that sometimes in real life situations. You know, maybe a couple have had a car accident and one of the couple has broken their leg and it's in extreme pain, but they're so concerned about their partner they don't even really notice their broken leg because they have so much focus on trying to help the other. So again, here, if we have this focus of compassion on others, not only is it a meaningful exercise to develop compassion, but also it can help to overwhelm the discomfort we feel. So these are some things that we can do when we're experiencing some sort of suffering. Any last question on that before we move on to the next topic?
Sometimes when you have suffering, you do try to like help other people in order not to concentrate on your suffering, but it's on the verge of ignoring what you're feeling.
Right. And so if we find that it's difficult to practice acceptance and we're just automatically going into aversion, then shifting focus can be helpful. Shifting focus because we're not focused on ourselves. But then, and so that can be helpful, but I think at the same time, we want to also try to start to develop acceptance. So it can be an effective short-term strategy just to shift focus. It can help. But again, together with that, it would be good to start to work on practicing acceptance as well.
How sometimes it does seem that acceptance is linked to resignation.
Yeah, but it's not resignation. See, resignation is actually aversion. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh no, nothing to do. So acceptance, again, is simply acknowledging in the present moment, I'm experiencing this. That's all that acceptance is. And then on the basis of acceptance, we can go, can I do something about this? Yes, fix it. Can I do something about this? No, it will pass. That's acceptance. Resignation is, oh, it's going to last forever, no hope, I'm doomed. And of course, as we saw the other day, the five qualities of suffering. Yeah. Those five qualities we looked at, you know. One of those, of course, is the compassion, which we talked about, but then the wish to avoid harmful behaviour, engaging in virtuous behaviour and so forth. Yes, of course. Right, let's go move on to the next topic. So here, what we've looked at now is the first two noble truths and how the process works. How we are stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara in the state of dukkha. So what I'd like to do now is how this whole cycle works in terms of how do we go from life to life and how does the whole cycle of existence work.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do first, for the rest of this morning, is have a look at the whole death rebirth process. And then this afternoon, I want to look at the whole Buddhist cosmology in terms of all the different types of existences and so forth, with that chart in your booklet. So that's this afternoon. But now I'd just like to look at the whole death rebirth process according to Buddhism. Generally, we talk about when we go through the death process, we go through 8 stages. And in the first 4 stages, this body, this coarse body, is shutting down. And within many systems, including Buddhism, when we talk about the physical world, we talk about what's called the elements, the 4, 5, or 6 elements. And during the death process, each of these elements loses its ability to function at a different stage. So at the first stage of the death process, we have what's called the earth element, which is the solid part of the body, the solid aspect of the body. The earth element loses its ability to function at the first stage. And when that happens, we have what's called an outer sign and an inner sign. The outer sign is what's going on in the physical body, and the inner sign is what's going on in the mind of the person who's undergoing this experience. So there are a number of outer signs here, but I'll just mention one as sort of an example. So one outer sign that the earth element has ceased its ability to function is that the person experiences their body, that their body feels heavy. They often report they have no strength, and they often report that they can't actually move their body. And they often say it feels like their body's sinking through the ground. So that's some of the outer signs here. Now, what's going on in the person's mind at that time is, due to that process happening, the person experiences what's called mirage-like appearances. And a mirage, or an example of a mirage, of course, is when we look out on a hot, sandy plain and it looks like water. There looks shimmering water. So similarly, here the person no longer has very clear mental images. Now the mental images are more like a mirage, more shimmering appearances. This is not with the eyes, but internally in the mind. At the second stage of the death process, the water element loses its ability to function. And the water element in the body, of course, is the fluid aspect of the body. So one of the outer signs here is that the fluids, the body fluids, begin to dry. You know, sometimes the person says they've got a dry mouth, for example, and so forth. The body fluids begin to dry up. The inner sign here is that the person now experiences mental images very hazy, very not clear anymore, very hazy. The analogy is like a smoke-filled room. A room full of smoke, you can't see things very clearly, very hazy. Thank you. At the third stage, the fire element loses its ability to function, and the fire element is the heat aspect of the body. And so the outer sign is that the body loses heat, particularly the extremities start to become cold.
Also the feeling? Also the body feeling?
Yeah, there are other outer signs here. We lose, I can't remember exactly, we also, in this stage, we lose the ability to hear sounds, see things, feel things in the body, but I can't remember exactly the stages, but this also happens in this process. So the body loses heat. The inner sign is that the person experiences now what's called spark-like appearances. You know, these sort of flashing spark-like appearances. Often in the Tibetan text that's describing this here, often the analogy you'll see that they use is firefly. You know, the little things that pulsate at nighttime, green light. So again, the idea is that there's this sort of spark-like appearance.
Over what span of time are those happening?
Sorry?
Over what span of time?
Okay. So the first four stages is the coarse body shutting down. These stages can take short time or long time, depending on the type of death the person is experiencing. If someone's dying from a sort of slow terminal illness, they may hover here for weeks, for quite some time, or it could be more quick. There's no fixed amount of time. It depends on the type of death the person's undergoing. But they go through the transition.
Just a question on that. Is that also dependent on their karmic imprints or their consciousness?
The type of death,
yeah,
or the time.
The process, the speed of.
No, the this is just based on the physiology of the body. That's all. The wind element, with respect to the body, of course, is the breath.
The air or wind?
Air, wind.
Yeah.
Air element, wind element. Same. The outer sign, of course, is that the person stops breathing. The inner sign at that time is that the person experiences a small white light. So here, of course, from a modern medical standpoint, the person is clinically dead. Breathing stops, brain activity stops. So what's happened here, of course, is that the coarse body, this body, has completely shut down, stopped functioning. And the mind we have now, as we saw, has a number of levels. We can talk about the coarse mind. The coarse mind is the mind that's active now, which is associated with this coarse body. So because the coarse body here has completely shut down, the coarse mind has completely shut down at this point. But from a Buddhist perspective, the
shut down in this case means
not active.
Or
not active.
But still existent.
Well, there's two ways you can talk about this. And both are valid. Like, let's say in the present moment, we're not angry. Is your anger dormant or your anger doesn't exist? I think both are okay, isn't it? There's no anger existing in the present moment. Or equally well, we could say our anger is dormant, not active. Yeah?
Yeah, but I'm just confused because you said that the first mind is tied to the body, so like, I'm just trying to understand if the Buddhist understanding is that the same coarse mind will then reawaken when the person is reincarnated, or if there's a new coarse mind, a different part of the mind is what
Well, our coarse mind is changing moment by moment now anyway, isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, our coarse mind is not the same as it was 2 minutes ago. Of course, in the next life, that coarse mind is associated with a very different body, but it's a similar coarse mind in that that coarse mind will have mental afflictions and perceptions and memories. And so in that sense, there's similarity. Like, you know, my coarse mind and your coarse mind are very similar in that respect in terms of experiences and how it functions.
Is the same coarse mind inherently tied or not inherently, but never mind.
So here, the coarse body shut down. So the coarse mind we have has shut down. It's become completely dormant. But from a Buddhist perspective, the death process is continuing, in that we have to go through what's called subtle and very subtle levels. So the next three stages, the subtle body is slowly shutting down. And the subtle body is a number of things incorporated in the subtle body. We have what's called channels. There's one what's called central channel down the body, two side channels, and then lots of channels going out from that. And within those channels, we have subtle energy flowing, in Sanskrit prana, sometimes called chi, subtle energy flowing in these channels. And along the central channel, we have what's called chakras. Here we have to be a bit careful. There are a number of different systems that talk about chakras, but what a chakra means is not always the same. In Buddhism, a chakra is a constriction around the central channel. It constricts the central channel in certain points, meaning it blocks the ability for subtle energy to flow in the central channel, these chakras. So we have a number of them along the central channel. And so we have these subtle energies flowing in the subtle body. And associated with the subtle energies is the subtle mind. So just like our coarse mind is associated with the coarse body, then the subtle level of our mind is associated with these subtle energies. And often the analogy used in Tibetan Buddhism is that the subtle energy is like a horse, and the subtle mind is like a rider on the horse. So in Tibetan Buddhism, we have the Tibetan word lungta, wind horse. You may have seen some prayer flags with a horse with wings. This is depicting this subtle energy that the subtle mind rides on. So over the next three stages, this subtle body is shutting down. At the fifth stage of the death process, it's called white appearance. What's happening here is all the subtle energies in the upper half of the body are withdrawing to the central channel and moving down to the heart chakra.
Sorry, what?
White appearance. So again, all the subtle energies in the upper half of the body are withdrawing to the central channel and moving down to the heart chakra. Now, of course, since the coarse body has completely shut down, there's no longer any outer signs. But the person does experience inner sign. So through the movement of this subtle energy down to the heart chakra, the person experiences a pervasive white experience. So a pervasive whiteness experience. Then at the sixth stage, it's moving down towards the heart chakra at this point, the upper part of the body. The sixth stage, called red increase, all the subtle energies in the lower half of the body are withdrawing to the central channel and moving up to the heart chakra. And due to that movement, the person experiences a pervasive redness experience. All the subtle energies in the lower half of the body are withdrawing into the central channel and moving up to the heart chakra. At the seventh stage, called black near attainment, and it's called black near attainment because we're close to attaining or reaching the actual state of death. So at the seventh stage, all the subtle energies now are enclosing the heart chakra. And because of that, the person experiences a pervasive darkness. Near attainment. Attainment means here close to actually achieving the state of death. So here they're experiencing this blackness and they're very close to actual death.
Sorry?
At this stage?
Yeah.
Seventh stage, now all the subtle energies are at the heart chakra and enclosing the heart chakra. And because of that, the person experiences a pervasive darkness. So now all the subtle energies have withdrawn. Subtle body has shut down. So therefore, subtle mind has shut down. So we've got one stage left. Stage 8. Now, what happens is the heart chakra opens and the very subtle mind, which is associated with a very subtle wind energy at the heart chakra, this very subtle mind becomes manifest. And because of that, the person experiences clarity. It's the very subtle mind becoming active. Because this very subtle mind, in a normal person, is always dormant. It only becomes active at this time of death. And because of that, the person experiences clarity. This is the very subtle mind. Now, in a normal person, at this point, then this very subtle mind would then disconnect from the coarse body and would enter into what's called an intermediate state between this life and next. In Tibetan, this is called bardo. After. So once we got to stage 8, then in a normal person, very quickly following that, this very subtle mind would disconnect from this body and enter into this intermediate state called the bardo. What's happening here is that we're in the process of moving to the next life. During the death process, and we're going to look this afternoon at how that mechanism works, a particular karmic imprint gets activated during the death process that will determine what the next life is going to be. And as we're going to see this afternoon, there are many possibilities, not just human. There are many possibilities of what that next life could be. And we'll look at that again in detail this afternoon. But so during the death process, one of these karmic imprints gets activated that's going to determine the type of future life we will have. And let's say for simplicity's sake, we're going to be a human again in the next life. Then once we disconnect from this body and enter into this bardo, this intermediate period, then that very subtle mind and body take on a subtle body and subtle mind. So we sort of go back up one level then. We take on a subtle body, subtle mind. So then we can talk about a bardo being, a living person that is actually in the bardo, not human, of course. But that bardo being is now programmed by that activated imprint to find conditions suitable to begin the next life. And again, let's say that it's programmed to be human again in the next life. Part of that condition necessary would be to find an egg being fertilized in the womb. So once it finds those suitable conditions, then the mind here connects with the fertilized egg in the womb and the new life begins. So from a Buddhist perspective, life begins at conception. And therefore you find often in Buddhist societies, when someone's born, they're actually considered to be 1 year old, even though it's 9 months. But often that's how they count their age, because that's what they consider, that life begins at conception. Now, how long does this bardo take? In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, what we often hear or read is that the maximum time anyone would spend in this state is 49 days. How we come up with 49 days, I'm not sure. And what we even mean by 49 days is not certain. Because are we talking about 49 days from our perspective or 49 days from that being's perspective? So what you find often then in Tibetan society, if someone has passed away in the family, then for a period of up to 49 days, they would do pujas and rituals in the hope that they could have some positive impact on this bardo being and hopefully steer it in a better direction. So that's why they do these pujas and so forth. So I didn't have to catch what you heard.
You can help in that 49 days, like your family, you can help
them. Remember, the bardo being has already been programmed, but also, of course, as we're going to see, we talk about the interconnected nature of reality. And also, these bardo beings, because they have a subtle mind, have a very powerful mind. It's often said that these bardo beings can see other types of beings and, in fact, can see where they were in the previous life. And it's even sometimes said in the text to the point where, initially, the bardo being doesn't even realise that they're dead. They think they're there where they were, but no one's talking to them. And they think, what's going on here? Because they don't realise they've actually died. And then at some point they realise, oh, I'm in the bardo. I think there was a movie like that, Sixth Sense or something, wasn't it?
I'm a little bit confused. I feel like I'm referring to the word samsara as being at least normally based in empiricism and kind of testable hypotheses. But this seems to be a fairly radical departure for me. I'm trying not to be closed-minded.
Sure.
I don't see how any of this could be tested empirically, and I don't know what the basis of this knowledge is, and I'm wondering if
sure.
it's metaphorical or
okay. If it's yeah. I was going to mention a little bit about that now, but I'll bring it in now, is that this very subtle, clear-like mind is completely non-conceptual and very powerful. And normally, in a normal person, it only becomes active at the time of death. However, if we can gain access to this very subtle mind in meditation, we can accelerate the spiritual path. And so this is really the practices in Tantra or Vajrayana. In Tantra or Vajrayana practice, We're trying to make that manifest in meditation by manipulating subtle energies, withdrawing all subtle energies to the heart chakra. And in that process in meditation, we go through those experiences. So this is directly reported by meditators as well, that they have these experiences in meditation without, of course, actually dying. So that's one place where you get the reports through meditators' direct experience of staying in this very subtle, clear-line mind. And then, of course, sometimes people have near-death experiences. And often through their own, they also report things. In fact, some years ago when I presented this, I had a young lady actually from Korea, South Korea, and she came to me after class and said, oh, when I was 18 I had a near-death experience, and she didn't say whether it was accident or illness, but she said, I more or less had these same experiences down to the red experience, and then she remembers coming back. I mean, of course she could be making it up, but that's what she reported. She said she more or less had the same experiences down to here and then came back. So, so in Tantra Vajrayana, the goal of the practice is to gain access to this in meditation and use this in our Vipassana practice. And so as part of that, we would have those similar experiences. And then from our own personal experience, we would validate those experiences.
Okay, I guess if you're not going to have a near-death experience, then we have to take this on faith. And that's why it's a departure from...
Right, so one more thing and then I'll address that. Is the other thing is that when we enter into the bardo, this is another type of existence, and as we're going to see this afternoon, from a Buddhist perspective, we can talk about six types of existences. We, as a human, can validate two. Human realm and animal realm. We, from our direct experience, we can validate that. The other four, most of us probably have no direct experience of them. Some people claim that they can see these other beings as well, including seeing bardo beings. Some people claim to be able to do that. And the Buddhist assertion is also that as we progress in the spiritual path and purify the mind, we will be able to gain the ability to directly perceive those other beings as well. Until that happens, of course, then for us, this is just this we can sort of see, but this is just a theory. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, what we don't want to do is accept this on blind faith. So, blind faith is really discouraged in Buddhism. So, what we really need to do is have a look at these things, see whether they make sense, whether they're beneficial for us, and if they're not, we can just leave them aside. And the Buddhist theory is that at some point, all of this stuff becomes a direct observation for us, but until then, we don't know.
And in point eight, yeah. What is the prana then actually doing? It's all withdrawing in the heart chakra?
In the heart chakra, there is one very subtle energy, and associated with that is the very subtle mind. Often that's called the indestructible drop, because they're never separated. So here we're talking about more coarse energies. They dissolve, and then all that's left here is this very subtle wind energy at the heart chakra.
And this is going to connect with the very subtle mind?
It's always connected with the very subtle mind, never separated, ever. It's always there. So the very subtle wind energy is there now, but of course we can't pick it up, we don't notice it.
So that also in Buddhism, prana and mind goes together from one life to the other.
So again, we have coarse body associated with coarse mind, subtle body associated with subtle mind, and very subtle body associated with very subtle mind. Yes, okay. Correct.
Why would you meditate if you could see your death process? Why would you meditate?
I didn't understand. What did you say, sorry?
Why, when you meditate, you can see the death process? What is the reason of this?
You have to do a particular type of meditation, and in that meditation, you are mimicking this process by withdrawing energies.
It's like the future, no? this process is like, what was it? It's like something that, it's like something about the future or not?
Well, this, from a Buddhist perspective, is what happens at our death time. But what I was saying is that in Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice, there are particular meditations that are basically involved going through the same process without, of course, actually dying. So those meditations, we would go through the same sort of process, because what we want to do is gain access to this very subtle mind in meditation. So then that person who's doing this would have these experiences.
It's two different processes?
Same process. So the person...
One is meditation, so it's like, it's not really the same, right?
Well, one in, the difference is one is uncontrolled and the other is controlled. Because having the ability to stop breathing is, from a, forget about Buddhists, but from a meditative perspective, is not difficult, relatively speaking. There are many traditions, also non-Buddhists, who do samadhi meditation where they stop breathing and they're still okay for a week. How that works?
Is this whole stage of death theory a Mahayana belief, a Tibetan belief, or all encompassing Buddhist belief?
Right. So even in Mahayana, normally you won't see any of this described. Because until you get to Tantra Vajrayana, it's of no use. It's only in Tantra Vajrayana where, by understanding this, we can harness this in meditation. So therefore, even in Mahayana, outside of Tantra, you won't see any of this. There'll be no talk about subtle, very subtle mind. You won't see it. You'll only see it in Tantra practice. Because in Tantra, we have methods to be able to harness this. So, of course, in Theravada, we don't see this. But also in Mahayana, you won't see this, except in Tantra. Yeah, I mean, also in Theravada, we talk about these things, don't we?
Okay.
I mean, that's just very common to all Buddhist traditions.
And can I make a comment to that gentleman over there? I just finished a book called Many Lives, Many Masters, and it's about a psychiatrist who put his patient under hypnosis for past life regression.
Sure.
And the patient reported all of this. And there's been many scientists, doctors, psychiatrists, who have done the same and have reported all of this as well. And the patient here talks about Bharata. She doesn't call it Bharata, but she talks about other spirits being around her, guiding her,
yeah, etc. And of course, this is not proof. It's evidence that may suggest this is possible, but there may be also equally other explanations to explain this. But certainly these sorts of things can lead a little, add a little bit of credence to maybe that this is possibly true. But is it proof? No, of course not.
I don't know if you're going to explain it later, but I've seen a documentary on Bible, and they say that when the being is in that state, he has the ability to go into enlightenment. But he needs to recognize
it. Okay, yeah, so now I'm going to add this. This is my next one. So, as I mentioned, except in Tantra Vajrayana, you won't really even see any explanation about any of this subtle, very subtle mind and body. But in Tantra, of course, we have these practices to withdraw subtle energies, bring them to the heart chakra, to cause this clear light mind to become manifest in meditation. But even in Tantra, extremely difficult to do. Extremely difficult to do. So therefore, even people who practice high levels of Tantra have a backup plan. And the backup plan is to develop the capacity to maintain awareness through the death process. Because if we can maintain awareness through the death process, then this clear light mind naturally manifests. We don't have to put any effort. It naturally arises in the death process. So then someone who's in Tantra who can't manage to gain access to this in meditation and thereby actually achieve enlightenment in the life, often have this backup plan of developing the capacity to maintain awareness through the death process. And often part of that, developing that ability, involves a lot of what's called dream yoga and sleep yoga. To develop the ability to do lucid dreaming and lucid sleep can be a good preparation for this. And so if we can maintain mindfulness, awareness throughout the process, then when we get to this point here, we can actually meditate in the death, at that time of death. And then someone who's gaining that ability can stay here for an extended period of time, days or even weeks. And during that time, the physical body, which of course long ago has stopped functioning, doesn't start to decompose, even in room temperature. And there have been many cases of this happening. In fact, my own teacher, who I did 7 years of study in Italy, he stayed in this state for 1 week in Italy, in the centre. And I wasn't there because I was here at the time. Some friends of mine who were students, you know, went into his room during that week, and they reported that he had a sort of radiant glow and had a sort of very pleasant smell in the room. And there also, there's up here in the forest, there's a stupa of another great meditator who spent a lot of time meditating in the forest here. And he stayed in this clear light for 2 weeks meditating. So there have been many cases of this happening. So the point is that if we can gain access to this very subtle, clear-light mind in meditation, great. Because we can, that's a very powerful mind, we can accelerate the spiritual path. Meaning that if we can use this mind instead of our coarse mind to realize nature of reality, we can wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions very quickly, and we can, in best case, achieve enlightenment in this very life. But to gain access to this in meditation, even in high-level tantric practice, very difficult. So the backup plan is to develop the ability to gain access to it at the time of death. And then in the time of death, you sit, you meditate, and in the best case scenario, you achieve enlightenment there. If not, you dramatically accelerate your spiritual path. Similarly, if you can maintain a mindfulness there, it's possible to maintain it into this state and do the same here. Lama Tsongkhapa, who the statues of the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, it's said that he did this, that he meditated at the time of his death and achieved enlightenment. This state in Tibetan is called Tukdam. That's a Tibetan word for it.
How is it possible to stay in meditative posture when your coarse and subtle mind lost connection to your body?
Exactly. Very good point. Is that what happens? And now I'll bring in what's called three levels of practitioner. We can talk about an advanced level practitioner. So an advanced level practitioner delights at the thought of death. Because for them, they have developed this ability, and that they know when they go through this process, they have a very good opportunity to achieve enlightenment or if not accelerate. So they're actually delight at the thought of death. So often for these people, and usually they have a lot of disciples because they're already fairly high level, what we often find is that later in their life, when their body starts to collapse, they will actually gather their students around and say, okay, it's time for me to move on. And they'll sit down in meditation posture and they'll just go through the process. And then hopefully, if not achieve enlightenment, accelerate the spiritual path. And for whatever reason, because remember here, when they're meditating here, the coarse body is shut down, so it should start decomposing. But there are many cases for days or weeks where that doesn't happen. So somehow this very subtle mind is nourishing the coarse body. And very often you'll see them sitting in meditation posture during that whole time.
Without breathing?
Yeah, no breathing. Breathing's long gone. Finished. A week ago.
Is it of importance that you
upper
that
energy.
Because I would think that the lower chakras are more associated with the coarse body, so they would go up first if the body shuts down first.
This, I don't know. I mean, this is what I've read, and so I'm no expert in this, but this is just coming from the Tibetan Buddhist texts. So remember, what we need to be a bit careful of is chakras and wind energies we find in Hinduism and other traditions, but we shouldn't assume that they're explained in the same way. In fact, they're not. They're not. So we need to be a little bit careful of that.
If someone dies suddenly, like a sudden death...
Yeah, then we'd get here very quickly.
Yeah, so it doesn't go through the first stages, but...
Well, they would probably be fairly simultaneous. I mean, they'd probably shut down very quickly. And then what happens here, I've never read. I've never read anything in the text. I don't know, is the answer.
What's the relationship that Buddhists have with the body? I mean, when can we start using the body? Burying it, cremating it, the body. Cremating it, burying it.
Because of this thing?
Yeah. In which level we can say, okay, the body is useless now.
Right. Yeah. Again, I've never personally read anything which says that from this stage, where you stop breathing, to the point where you disconnect, how long that takes. I've never seen any... But my own personal opinion on what everything I've read is that this time, a normal person is very quick. So if you want to do organ donation, by the time they come to harvest the organs, it's gone. And I've read, there was on one website where someone did a lot of research about different religions and their policy on organ donation. And of course, some promote it, some say no way. And when it comes to Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, what I've read is that most of the commentators in Tibetan Buddhism say, if you have a compassionate motivation, do it.
You can't be stuck if you meditate at the clarity point. You meditate for clarity and you can... I heard a story of someone who did meditate like this for years, till now I think maybe, and his body started to be brown, they put glass
I don't know. I mean, I've not ever heard that. I mean, there is another type of meditation, because this is culminating in the passionate insight meditation. We can also do the samadhi meditation, just developing deep levels of concentration. And there are some very high levels of deep concentration, which are nothing to do with this, of course. They're just working with the coarse mind, where, in theory, that's possible to happen, that they end up in this absorption for a long time. But that's nothing to do with this. That's something completely different.
Going back to my earlier point,
sure.
The being is embargo.
Yeah.
What I understood is that, like, because you're seeing other beings, if you feel like you're attached to them and you want to connect with people, then you get stuck. But if you're able to recognize that this is all attachment and nature of reality, you could attain enlightenment and be free.
Right, but I think for that to happen, you would have to have that ability to maintain mindfulness. I think a normal Bardo being won't have that capacity to do that. Oh, I didn't finish my three levels of practitioner. So an advanced level practitioner delights at the thought of death, because for them they have this ability and they have a chance of achieving enlightenment. Then we have what's called a middling level practitioner. And a middling level practitioner is someone who maybe doesn't have this ability, but they can navigate their way through. For them, the whole death rebirth process is just a transition. So they have no fear of death, it's said. And then we can talk about initial level practitioner, who maybe has a bit of fear of death, but at least an initial level practitioner has no regrets at the time of death, because they've done the most they can in their life, and even though they may have a bit of fear about death, they're happy with what they've done in their life. They're not regretting that they've wasted their life. So therefore, I think we all can aspire to at least that, to have no regrets at the time of death, to make our life as meaningful as possible. And unfortunately, in our modern society, we actively tend to avoid death. You know, we sort of hide it away. You know, it's not very common to see a dead body unless it's actually at a relative's funeral. Where here in India, of course, you see them carrying them down the road often. But in our Western society, we've sort of sanitized that, and we've even sort of sanitized a little bit old people, you know, putting them away in old people's homes and so forth. So we tend to try to put away things that remind us of death, unfortunately. And what that often leads to is fear and anxiety about death. And that was really highlighted to me some years ago when I was talking, I can't remember the topic, and at one point I said, we can't even be certain that we'll be alive tomorrow. And at that point, a lady in the audience, she gasped, you know, she went like this. And she, after the class, she came to me and said, oh, I'm sorry about that. She said, I'm from Singapore. And she said, when I grew up, it was forbidden to speak about death in our family, forbidden. And she said, because of that, she grew up with a lot of fear and anxiety about death. And now she said she was trying to overcome that. So I think that if we can really be open about death and reflect on death, rather than making that anxious, actually we can get to know, understand death. And through that, we can actually understand the preciousness of this life. Because we tend not to take advantage of or understand something is very important until we're about to lose it or we've lost it. So, therefore, we only really understand the preciousness of something when we've lost it or about to lose it. So, similarly, if we don't reflect on death, often what we do is we don't understand the preciousness of our life. And so we don't tend to make our life very meaningful. And it's only later in our life, as we're approaching death, then we start to have regrets. So we can really avoid that by reflecting on death and thereby understanding the preciousness of our life. And this is something that often spontaneously happens with people who've had near-death experiences because they've directly seen death, and often as a result, they understand the preciousness of their life. And often their lives are very much transformed, and they really want to take advantage of their life. So, of course, we don't need to have a near-death experience for that to happen. If we simply reflect on death, we can understand the preciousness of our life and we want to make our life meaningful. Okay, I think that's about all I wanted to mention at the moment. What I'm going to do this afternoon, of course, is then what happens after this? You know, what goes on after that? That's going to be the topic for this afternoon. So maybe now time for a few questions down the back.
What is it? The enlightenment people are not dead or something. They avoid death and sleep.
Right, yeah. So this is something I'm going to talk about this afternoon. But what we're talking about here is a process in which a normal person has no control. We just go through the process. And then depending on how we've led our life, it will depend where we end up in the future. We've got really no... The only control we've got is how we lead our life. So if we lead our life in a good way and be ethical and avoid harmful behaviour, then we've sort of gone a long way to ensure that some sort of good imprint ripens here and we end up in a good place in the future. That's the level of control we have now, is just how we lead our life. We don't really have any control through this process. So then for us, this process is called rebirth. So when we use the word rebirth, it implies no control in the process. When we advance in the path, we can start to have some ability to control or navigate. If we can do that, we can sort of navigate where to go in the next life. Then, technically, we wouldn't say rebirth, we would say reincarnation. We would use that word. It's a little bit of a technical difference, but we'll talk more about that this afternoon.
You state that lucid dreams could help?
Help, yeah.
But I know that lucid dreams implies brain activity. And actually, the stronger brain activity than just sleeping. But I mean, if you are dead, there is no more brain activity.
Correct. So, but lucid dreaming is more difficult than being lucid in waking state. And lucid sleep is more difficult than lucid dreaming, because we're connecting with a more subtle level of mind. So if we can develop lucid dreaming and lucid sleep, we're already starting to be able to maintain awareness in a little bit subtler level of mind. Of course, we're not saying lucid sleep and lucid dreaming is here. We're not saying that at all. But what we're saying is that lucid dreaming and lucid sleep is definitely a much more subtle level of mind than the waking mind, which means that we're starting to develop the ability to maintain mindfulness with a more subtle level of mind.
So when a person dies, how many days we have till we can do the ceremony or the putting in a grave? And
in a normal person, immediately.
So
if it's a high-level meditator, and then usually people know that it's a high-level meditator, and they're sitting, then we can put them in cremate or burn, or put them in a coffin when their body starts to decompose and smell.
But okay, but the normal person immediately
straight away. Yeah, this is very quick. We can't have the ability to stay here as a normal person. We're just straight through.
What's the purpose of becoming enlightened when you're dead?
What's the purpose of becoming enlightened in general?
No, when you're dead.
In this point here?
Yeah.
Well, because then we don't have to take rebirth and enter suffering again.
What? What happened?
Yeah, but that's what's coming. We haven't got to that bit yet. So I'm going to talk about that tomorrow morning. Because tomorrow morning I'm going to talk about a little bit more the difference between nirvana and enlightenment. So that's coming tomorrow morning.
Does anybody comment on the... Because it seems that it would be so useful if you remember, like at the bardo stage, you're your clear, you're your very subtle self. So you all of a sudden have a much clearer grasp on the nature of reality.
Sure.
If you were able to remember that in your next birth, it would make the process much more... I mean, you would really see people... I don't know.
That's right.
Progress much faster. So why... Does anybody comment on why? Because there's a cut. We don't remember our past lives. We don't remember that moment of clarity that we had.
Right.
I mean, does anybody see if there's a tragedy in that?
And the question is...
If we remember that clarity...
Sure, we could use it.
We could use it.
Exactly. That's why if we can develop the ability to do that. And that's what we find in Tantra. In Theravada and Mahayana, apart from Tantra, we don't see any talk about this because there's no practices to develop that ability. So they don't mention it. And particularly like in Theravada, I think there's no mention of bardo. We finish this life and immediately we start the next life. Because to explain that intermediate state is of no benefit. It doesn't help. Because we can't do anything about it.
But if there are some imprints so that practitioners...
Sure.
Also when they are practicing in Theravada or Mahayana without Tantra... So if they are experiencing some subtle or very subtle energies and things during meditation, how is this then going to be explained if it's not in the system?
I think it's just explained as subtle sensations in the body. If you have some subtle energy, because it is, you experience it as some sort of subtle sensation.
And why is it not part of this?
Because in this levels of practice, there's no practices to manipulate subtle energies at that level. Of course, I'm not talking about a very simple way of manipulating subtle energies in Reiki and certain Tai Chi and Qigong and stuff. I mean, that's a very simple level of subtle body work. Here we're talking about withdrawing all subtle energies into the central channel. And even in Tantra, that's sort of the highest level of practice. You won't even be introduced to that until you have a very solid basis in Tantra. You won't even hear about those practices until you're ready, because they either won't work or they're going to harm you. Because subtle body work, if you do it out of control, can damage the mind. Because the mind and body, mind and subtle energy like this, if we don't manipulate subtle energies in a controlled fashion, we can damage the subtle mind irreversibly. I mean, there are many cases of Westerners dabbling in, you know, I hear about, there was an example just a couple of years ago, and then we need to stop. There's often workshops here, Kundalini Awakening Workshop. 5 days, guaranteed. And I had, in this class a couple of years ago, I was mentioning, tomorrow we talk about Tantra and the dangers of doing this, and he came to me and said, yes, this has happened to his friend. He went to this Kundalini Awakening Workshop, and they pushing him to get this experience. He had some sort of experience, and he became completely delusional. His parents had to fly out to India to take him home. He was that far delusional.
Yeah, I met a woman in
there. Yeah, I mean, it's so powerful, and if we can't harness it, we can really damage our mind. It's not something to play with. But of course, I can get some bliss. I need it. I want some bliss. Big cost. Okay, let's stop there. We've run out of time. So, discussion group questions. This morning we talked about this process of how the short-term strategy of how to reduce that six-step process, and we talked a lot about there about just being mindful of sensations, being mindful of mental afflictions and so forth. The first question is, how would mindfulness help us to overcome our mental afflictions? How would mindfulness help us to overcome our mental afflictions? And the second part of the first question is, what other benefits does mindfulness bring us? And the second question is about these four opponent powers we looked at this morning, a way to overcome our negative imprints and negative habits. The question is, discuss practical ways of overcoming negative habits using the four opponent powers. So discuss practical ways of overcoming negative habits using the four opponent powers.
Yeah.
Discuss practical ways of overcoming negative habits using the four opponent powers.
What is exactly mindfulness? Mindfulness. What is it exactly?
Mindfulness is, the Sanskrit word is smriti, the Pali word sati. And those words literally mean memory. So mindfulness is remembering the object. So mindfulness is our ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. This is mindfulness. Sorry? So, yeah, the main tool we use in shamatha practice is mindfulness. We're trying to strengthen our mindfulness. We're trying to hold the object better and better and better. So we're strengthening our mindfulness. What we need to be aware of, this word mindfulness in many modern day traditions is used a little bit different to that. Often mindfulness in modern day traditions is defined as something like a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Very good thing to do, but that's not how mindfulness was defined in the original Buddhist texts. So we need to be aware of that difference. But mindfulness is simply our ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. Remembering the object. That's it. Mindfulness will lead us to develop concentration. Mindfulness is a mental factor that helps us to develop concentration. It's a mental factor that we strengthen in meditation. Particularly, we strengthen it in shamatha practice. Okay. Third question. We looked at the death-rebirth process here. So the third question is, how would the concept of rebirth affect the way in which we would lead our life? How would the concept of rebirth affect the way in which we would lead our life? And the second part of the third question is, if we have no belief in rebirth, would we lead our life differently? If we have no belief in rebirth, would we lead our life differently? No belief in rebirth, would we lead our life differently?